tell you a little about our guest. His bio reads, Joakko J. Kusi is a Ghanaian writer, filmmaker, and podcaster. His focus is on telling stories that have soul. His work includes the feature film Lucky and a short film called Boy Boy They Cry, or Boy No They Cry. He's the creator and producer of Check Your DM, a podcast that brings real stories of how young African celebrities navigate life, career, dating, and sex in the age of social media. Obviously, there's a lot more to him, and we'll discover more when he joins me in the studio. Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Arts Africa Show. How are you today?
I'm excited. I'm here with you.
Okay. Tell us about your week. How's your week been?
My week has been, what's today? Today is Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah, so I've had a great week. Like I told you earlier on before our conversation, I'm trying to work on a new project. Mm-hmm. So I've been watching more reference shots. I've been watching more reference shows. I've been going over to the script, reading over, and I was in Tamale on Tuesday. Okay. And it was a great experience.
What was happening in Tamale?
I went to Tamale to see these women who have been working in Shea Butter. It's like this, and they have been. It's a generation, like, it's been there. They've been doing this like across generations, and mm-hmm. like it's a little village, and that's what they are known for. It's a beautiful place.
Have you eaten the shea fruit?
Interestingly, like, they're out of shea fruits now. It's out of season. You know, it's seasonal, so like they have a lot of the shea nuts over there, but the fruits are.
Because I ate a few. I was in Yendi. Mm. Couple of months ago.
No, but I have tried the fruits, which is like one of the things that
it
reminds me of my childhood, honestly, because that was when I ate that fruit, and mm-hmm. I lived in Burkina Faso briefly for like a cool 3 to 4 years. So it was
where in Burkina were you?
I live in Ouagadougou, Bomé, like here. So I lived there for like 4 years.
I've just passed through Ouaga on my way to Bamako. Mm. Yeah. Because I did the trip by bus.
Ah, I feel you. I mean, you look like someone who really likes to go on a lot of road trips. And
yes, I love transport of all forms. So I like traveling by boats. I've done pony trekking in mountains. I've been on a shikara. You know, any type of transport that goes from A to B, love it.
Ah, all she's saying is that she has lived. And
love it. Okay, I want the backstory of your name because it's unusual.
I don't know. I've never really had to find myself in a space where I've had to explain my name. But then my name had always been like a conversation starter.
Yeah.
And I think it's about time I actually talk to my father, ask him where he got that name from.
Dude, really?
Interestingly, I've never really had to ask for what my name is, like what my name means.
Were you ever teased for it?
I was never teased for it.
Because I was teased for my name, Alba. Which is like,
Alba is a beautiful name.
It's an unusual name. And so people, I mean, I have people saying to me, hey, we are sure it's not Abba. And
hey,
I'm like,
hey,
dude,
hey,
how long have I been on this planet?
To make it Alba.
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, I used to get called Albatross and, you know, kids. So anyway, I'm glad that you came through life with that name unscathed.
Mm, yes. And I think growing up, I like my name the more I like growing up, because I feel like in a space
unique.
In a space where I think I'm headed when it comes to my career, it's unique. Like when I mention my name, there isn't like either you know me or you don't. It's just that one person.
Yeah.
So far, I haven't met anyone with that name.
But it will be interesting to find the backstory of that.
We'll have that conversation. When I find out, I'll come back on this show. We'll talk about it.
Okay, so we met at the Black Star Film Festival. Yeah. We were on a panel for script writing. And you had a very specific aesthetic.
Ooh.
And I loved your nail varnish. That color of nail varnish, I'm going to look for it, because I was like, this is a really beautiful color. And I was hoping you would wear it today, but you didn't.
I have just the yellow.
You have the remnants of, I looked at your nails when you came in. I was like, remnants of the, but what's the name of that color again?
I do not know. So I think that day when I went there, they gave me about, if I'm not exaggerating, like thousands of colors to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wearing a shirt that was like the same shade, and mm-hmm. it's closer it's closer to gray than it is to blue, and
it also feels like it's got a sort of even some a little purple.
Ah,
in there
now
somewhere.
I think I need to go get back Daniel again.
Yeah, it's an
I'm going back to that. I'm going back to that.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
I'll go
color.
Back to it.
How important is clothes and visual aesthetics in your?
I feel
because
like
you were looking super fly at the, was that specially for the panel thing, or is that like
honestly,
your style?
It wasn't. I think anyone who had seen me or anyone who knows me just know I like to be super comfortable. Like mm-hmm. you are likely to catch me in like oversized pants, oversized shirt, and then and interestingly in my pajamas. Like you are more likely to meet
oh
me
God,
in my pajamas.
Like they're doing in China at the moment. Every
basic
wearing pajamas. It's so horrible.
For me, it's comfort. Like, I just want to be comfortable. Like, one of the things, I woke up this morning and I knew I was coming to meet Albert today. And I was like, what do I really want to wear? And for me, it's comfort. It's comfort.
No, but come off it, your suit, what you were wearing the other time, it had like a sheen to it. Even the color, the
and
color
also,
was unusual.
And also, it's not unusual. I really love colors.
No, but it's an unusual color to see on a man.
Whoa, you could as well tell, like, my nails were super unusual as well, considering the space I find myself. Like, it's unusual
yeah,
to find those nails on a man as well. So for me, it's been about...
But I'm seeing it more and more. Usually, maybe it might be
a nail
or two. I think, you know, the conversations that are happening... Damn, everybody needs to look good.
Everybody
needs
to look good.
Wants to look good. And so,
everybody
needs
to look good.
You know, if you want to, obviously, there are the Billy Porters of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of men will not go to that, that extent. But, I mean, what's wrong with throwing on a bit of face powder just to, you know, give your skin a little, you know.
So I have this interesting story, right? A friend showed up one day and he was so excited. He's like, he got his nails done today. He painted his nails today. He went for like a pedicure and he looked at it and he's like, so why? Why for a very long time have they made it like a no-no for men to get this? He's like, I can tell the difference. My nails look good. My feet are breathing. Like,
But once upon a time, it was men who wore high heels. It was men who, you know, wore the wigs and powder. You know, at least in Europe, that was all the things that we now class as women's things actually started off as male things.
But then I just feel like the more and more people like myself are super comfortable in what
exactly.
they do. I mean, even right, I walked in here with two earrings. I walked in here with dreadlocks and everything.
Yeah, I always... It's like,
whenever
know?
I'm talking, I always tell people, like, I have been in the corporate space. I've worked in corporate spaces where I had my hair on. I've been able to be in a space where people actually acknowledge me for, like, what I do and for what I am, instead of, like, what I look like. And I feel like that is something I'm super excited.
But I think we're growing as a people.
I do not think we are growing as a people real quick. I do not think we are growing
no,
as...
No, but I don't think things like that happen quickly.
Honestly?
They don't happen quickly anywhere.
That's true.
And then also... When you're in a space where it's a small minority that are doing that, which means then the change takes a little longer,
mm-hmm.
longer to happen. But, you know, bit by bit.
We'll get there.
Okay. First step is we want to take a look into your reading habits. Mm. What kind of genres do you like to read?
So, I like to read. I like to read a lot of drama.
Mm-hmm.
I like to read a lot of migration stories on immigration, stories on migrate, like themes like that. Because I've been super interested, and my reading habit is influenced by project I'm working on at a particular point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm really going to read, I just catch myself. It's not conscious. Or maybe the reading determines what I want to write. Because, like, I realize that when I go into reading, right after reading, I start writing and it hits me, oh,
okay,
you might have been influenced by this
that.
Or that.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I read, like, a lot of things. I read, like, anything I lay my hands on.
Okay. What are you reading right now?
Oh, so right now I'm reading this book called Under the Odara Tree.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those books that I've been trying to read it. I've been trying to read it for a while, and I keep postponing because I've been writing. So, like I said, on my flight to Tamale, I was like, okay, you know what? I think I need to see what this book is about, and I started, and I couldn't drop it. And
I read it. I bought it at the you know the Peja.
Yeah, Peja Festival
has
finished.
Just finished. 2 years ago, I got that book there. I love it.
Yeah, yes. I really love the writing.
Yeah.
I love the writing so much.
Okay. I'm reading the autobiography of Grace Jones at the moment.
How is that coming along?
She's an amazing...
What do you think of her?
I as a kid, like around the age of 8, 9... I wanted to be like Grace Jones. I loved how out there she was and how comfortable she was and how groundbreaking she was. It was like, oh my God, she was like the most mesmerizing thing.
There was a moment, though, I think for me, there was a moment I actually thought she was a fictitious character.
Oh, really?
Because she was too amazing. Like, yeah. I just felt like
and
she was.
And I also like the, you know, she was, at least for me, one of the first sort of androgynous types of people where obviously with the kind of men she hangs out with, you know, she's like a super sexual, you know, I shouldn't use the word creature, but there's something very panther-like.
But then she was able to have like the bridge between
she
was sexy without like in your face, without trying to like I'm sexy.
There was a strength to her. I think even the kind of thing that I think even Naomi Campbell has, there's a something about her that I think even some men, you know, she's not the kind of woman you're just gonna hey baby or wolf whistle, because you would not even have the courage to, you know.
She was so beautiful.
Yeah.
She is.
Okay, so what book are you reading?
I'm reading Under the Odara Tree, like you said, but I have read my favorite book. My favorite book had been Here Comes the Sun. Here Comes the Sun.
What's
and
that about?
And you've heard about it? You
no,
haven't?
I haven't. That's
why. So it's about this girl who works in this. I think the common theme that it explored is the black tax.
Yes.
He explored the black tax in Jamaica, and I think it's in Jamaica, and I think it's one of my favorite books because I do not have the hard copy here, but I have the soft copy. So I mean, I could read a few pages for you, or if you don't mind. It's set in Jamaica, and it did really explore the black tax, and it did explore like the tourism and sex tourism as well. And
that's then, all over the Caribbean.
It did explore sex tourism.
I used to live in Cuba.
Oh.
And sex tourism there is also another. But, you know, they don't say... Jinetera is the name. And I remember I was at film school. Me and a Spanish friend, she was the director. I was editing the movie for her. And we just wanted to go on a little break. So we went to a very popular beach town called Baradero. And, you know, cool. And we've got where we're going to stay. And we're like, we're going to enjoy the beach and have some drinks and, you know, go to a few shows and that. Man, we tried to enter a hotel and they stopped us. They would not allow us to enter because they thought we were prostitutes coming to look for clients. I didn't know whether to feel offended or to feel like, okay, so
I'm hot. You could throw some money for this.
You know, that kind of thing. But we had to go back to our where we were staying with we stayed with a friend's cousin. We had to go and bring our passports to show them that we were not Cuban.
Then you
girls,
really so wanted to enter this space.
We just wanted to go there.
To prove a point?
No, and just have a nice meal. We'd come with an agenda. We're going to do the beach. We're going to go to Las Palmas Hotel and eat the best at their restaurant. So we had a checklist.
Whole agenda. And your sexism isn't about to...
And then you know, we try, and Lydia was like white and blonde-haired.
Ah.
And we we get to the entrance of the hotel, they thought we were coming to look for clients. And as I said, I don't know whether to feel flattered or offended.
It depends on how you look at it. Yeah. I would be flattered if you think I'm a sex worker. I mean, you want to throw some money for this? Okay.
But then saying that, I mean, I've been in places where I've seen sex workers and I've wondered, again, stereotypically, because you think a sex worker is going to be this beautiful, stunning, whatnot. And you see some of them, teeth are missing out, but you know, there's all kinds of tastes.
No, but then they are actually, you would be surprised someone will go back and stay if they don't find Jacinta down the street.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, let's read a little bit about.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Here Comes the Sun, right?
Here Comes the Sun by Nicole Dennis.
Ah, yeah.
Yes.
Part one is God No Like Ugly. Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite things is that, like, she was able to write, you could feel the language and let me just read. So Here Comes the Sun, part one, God No Like Ugly. The long hours Margot works at the hotel are never documented. Her real work is not in answering the telephones that ring off the hook, or writing up delinquent housekeepers for sleeping on the beds and watching TV when they are supposed to be cleaning. Her real work is after hours when everyone had bid their goodbyes and piled up in the white Corolla's robot taxis at the massive gates of the resort, which will take them home to their shabby neighborhoods away from the fantasy they help create about a country where they are as important as washed up seaweed. Margot has been employee of the month for several months in a row because she was the first to arrive and the last to leave. And for good reason, requests are called in, not in conversational tones, but in code that only Margot knows, in case anyone is listening on the line. Aki means he wants to taste her down there. Foreign men love that. Banana means he wants to suck her. He wants her to suck him off. Sunday means he intends to be kinky. Anything goes. Of course, they know she is in business because she makes sure to slip them a wink on the first day of their arrival. Flattered, they initiate conversation. Margot flirts, reading their stray glances, and almost always land and linger between her exposed cleavage. That is Margot's cue for a forward invitation. She goes to the employee restroom to freshen up, spray perfume between her breast and powder on her face before sauntering to the client's room. She undresses for the client, whose main goal is usually to satisfy a deep curiosity that he never had the balls to satiate with the women in his own country, like a black woman's breast, for instance. Many of these men want to know the shape of them, the nipples, whether or not they were the same color as tar pressed on the heels of their leather shoes from the paved roads in Europe or America, or if black nipples have in them the richness of topsoil after thorough rain shower. They want to touch, and she lets them. Their eyes widen like children ogling baby frogs for the first time, careful to hold them so they don't spring from their grasp. She doesn't see it as demeaning. She sees it as merely satisfying the curiosity of foreigners. Foreigners who pay her good money to be their personal tour guide on the island of her body. Margot stashes the money in her purse and then she's done and hurries home. By then, the robot taxis are scarce. So she walks into town and waves for one of them. She has a long ago ride. She was long ago rid herself of any feelings of disgust. She used to stay back and shower in the client's washroom, scrubbing off every part of her until her skin was raw. These days, she goes straight home and falls asleep with a smell of semen sunken in her pores. Replacing the disgust is a liquid hope that settles inside her chest and fills her with a purpose. She rolls over in the bed she shares with her sister, knowing that one day she won't have to do this, that one day Tandy will make everything better, but until then she must work.
Yep.
So what do you think?
totally understand.
So this is the lead character, and we follow her story, and then her story is actually just bigger than she being a sex worker in this big resort that she works at. And she has a cat sister called Tandy, and Tandy is still in junior high school getting ready for uni. So they use her and Tandy and their mother to explore a bit of black tax in Jamaica, which is because she was working off in the hotel and working as a sex worker to take Tandy to school. For her, Tandy was a part of her dreams that in the future, Tandy was going to like get a good job and take care of her. And then as the story progresses, we realize how that heaps a lot of responsibilities on Tandy, who is a young girl who had barely started life, who wants to live for herself.
But she can't because
there's this knowledge of your sister knowing that she's doing all this for you. So I look back and I'm like, this isn't just something that is unique or that is distinct to people who live in Jamaica. I think it's an African thing.
It's a black people thing.
Where you only get enough, and then there's this survivor's guilt as well, where you only get enough to make yourself comfortable, but outside of the circle you are expected, so people can't move forward. You don't know whether the phone rings, is the home calling you, your grandmother just swallowed a billboard.
I think it's a change, you know, a change of mindset, and I think maybe this generation might do it, in the sense that you can't think about growing old without putting a plan into place. Because at the end of the day, yes, you put children into this earth, you paid for them to go to school, but that was your choice. They don't owe you anything. And I think in our setting,
that becomes a tad bit problematic, especially.
Yes, yes, because the point is, you owe me, literally. And that means that I then can't do my life because I now have to look after you.
There is this sense of entitlement that you have to do it.
And also I think a lot of people are also guilt tripped by them.
It is the guilt. That's what I was talking about, the survivor's guilt.
There is
the guilt that, in as much as, let's say, you could find a young person who's like just out of school, he ends quite, let's say, middle class family, like the dwindling middle class family, which we know it all is dwindling so fast under this economy. We don't know if, like, in the next few years, it's just gonna be the higher class and then the people, the haves and the have-nots. And basically, you just need to find a way if you still want to live here, or if you still want to live it, find a different place to call home. But then the young person starts working. You're able to rent a decent space, which you are required to pay for 2 years in advance, which is like, how many people can do that? But then you just do that. And then you cannot really want to do anything because, like, your phone could ring at any time. You meet young people and then you talk. So I realized that was something I was interested in. Started talking to more young people and I realized, actually a thing.
The burden
is a thing. So you see young people trying to, it seems like they are not married, they don't have any children yet, they don't have any responsibility yet. But then
they have
a lot of responsibilities, like, looking back. So that was why I read the book, and it really opened my eyes to something that was really happening around me that I hadn't even taken note of. Because I know friends who are always working, but then, like, they barely have anything. And it's like,
to feed the family.
Yeah, because they, and it's not something, it's not a conversation we have openly.
And then you even have things like, I mean, obviously, when these conversations start, people always think of a certain university, but you have young ladies who maybe parents can't afford the kind of schooling, they find somebody who is financing their education but also helping their family.
There is that.
And then as a parent, you then lose the moral high ground because you're also being fed through your child's sex work.
But then I just feel like this is like a super, super really delicate conversation about and interestingly, whether we like it or not, boomers, I'm sorry to say this, but, well, I don't really think I need to apologize to say this, but I feel it's a conversation. We are not like a speaking people. We don't talk. We don't have these conversations. We don't find young women. We don't even find young women talk to, like, younger women. You don't find older. I mean, we don't find older women talk to younger men like talking to younger girls. We don't find older men talking to younger boys. I mean, like, it's a conversation that no one is really having.
And it feels like as if there's two different worlds.
And there's a shift. There's a generational shift. Yeah. There's a generational shift that's like happening. It's happening real quick.
Yeah.
It's happening real quick. And if you look around, even if you look around right now and what is happening in government, what is happening on TV, what is happening, like, what we've been in a space where for how long? For like the last month, we wake up every morning and what is really happening on our breakfast shows? We are either deciding whether a dreadlock guy should be given education, or we are actually deciding whether people, whether minority groups should be living. We are actually deciding, like, you get people who come on TV, who come on radio stations and their platform, well, to talk about why a dreadlock guy should be.
But do you know where the problem from that stems from? If you want to be a doctor, mm-hmm. you have to go through years of schooling.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be a lawyer, same thing. Engineer, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
To own a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
where you influence people's minds, to own a TV station, anybody with money can do that. And so, and I don't know if there are any rulings. For instance, in certain countries, 60-70% of what's on TV needs to be locally produced. There's a percentage that can be foreign imports. I don't know what the playing ground is here. And so if somebody decides to be at head of things like TV and radio, and there's no real agenda about the kind of content you want to put out there or the importance of that medium in how it shapes society, then you're gonna get that.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna get, and a lot of it is knee-jerk reactions, and it's about,
it's just for a spur of the moment.
Yes.
Just to get it, it's
and to get and to get and we like scandal and salacious stuff and drama.
It's sad. It's
yes.
sad, and it's super sad to be in a space where there's no progress.
Mm.
'Cause growing up, right? I don't know if you schooled in Ghana, like, but then growing up in Ghana, right? Anyone who schooled in Ghana knows what social studies has been like. They ask questions in social studies from JSS to high school. The problems had been bad roads. The problem had been unemployment. The
mm-hmm.
problems have been, like, the problems, like, we kept the answers my father gave to these same problems were the answers I came to give to this problem. They are the same answers my nephew is giving to these problems. So then we just live in a space where what is really happening?
Well, we shall find out. wherever. Okay, so the next song on our Reggie Rockstone playlist is Mapuka. And it is featuring Lord Lust and Mensa. Okay,
mm-hmm.
little story behind this. I directed that video. And I was like the only woman on the crew. I was the director. And, you know, that was like at the height of Reggie's fame. And all these girls were hovering around, like 300 of them. Like, all the
girls,
they just came. And you know, Reggie was looking at them. You know, he's making eye contact with some of them. So they were all feeling cool. Like, oh, I'm the chosen one. And then they were distracting the guys on set, obviously, with their presence. So I'm like, could you all leave? And some of them like, I'm not going. You know, until the producer had to come and kick everybody away. But it was like a really intense shoot. But we had a lot of fun. So this is Mapuka with Reggie, Lord Lust, and Mensa.
Reggie Rockstone, Mensa, Lord Lust.
Money makes the world go round, and I believe that, but I'ma go around for you. The way you do that dance, my Mapuka effect, and I'm giving it up to you. Money makes the world go round, and I believe that, but I'ma go around for you. The way you do that dance, my Mapuka effect, and I'm giving it up to you.
Mapuka.
La secousse, secousse.
Mapuka.
Bouge là, on danse ça, on danse ça.
Mapuka.
Tiens-moi et tout ça, et tout ça.
Oh, oh. And you don't stop, keep moving. I love it when you do the Mapuka. Puka like that. The power that your body generates don't make me wanna rap. Uh-huh. You're making these Jamaican women look so whack. Uh-huh. Pure African rhythm, the way you make the booty act. Love the rudeness with the artistic movements. Only words coming to my mind is that goodness. Who be my witness for this be the true definition of the black princess with a thickness. Break down all man's wickedness. Got you saying stuff that don't make no sense. My Puka dance, so intense. Make you go home and talk trash to your girlfriends.
Yo, you killing me, mom. My asthma attacks. Watching you rock that booty. My memories verily telling me none of my head gets boozy. Do me. Surrender to your power. I'ma do whatever you say. Hurt me. I see your hip and get thirsty. Sip a little Kool Aid. My well be a good day. How many times do I gotta remind ya? Baby, that I think you got a great future behind ya. I'm telling you, pa, your melody get a sweater for banging the heart. I swear it could blind ya. Mapuka, yo, I'm glad that I found ya. Heard about this dance, but I called it propaganda. Till I saw you do it on cannibals and random. Shaking away straight from the under. And you's about to blow up like a blender.
My movie makes a go around and I believe that, but I'ma go around for you. The way you do that dance, Mapuka, facts, and ma, I'm giving it up to you. Money makes a ball go round, and I believe that, but I'ma go around for you. The way you do that dance, my puka facts, and ma, I'm giving it up to you.
My puka.
Dans la secousa, secousa.
My puka.
Bouge là, on danse ça, on danse ça.
My puka.
Tiens-moi et tout ça, et tout ça.
Ooh, ooh. And you don't stop, keep moving.
My puka danse, alors chouchou, voilà ta chance. Montre à l'orthodoxe comment tu bouges tes hanches. Pendant que je lance des hits avec Régis, je pense que j'aimerais voir secouer tes fesses. Oui, mademoiselle, tu viens de la côte ouest. Quoi ma belle, je viens de la côte ouest. Alors what's next, M-E-X-T. Ce soir, tu dois me fixer. Même si on danse jusqu'à 6h du matin. Petit déjeuner dans mon grand jardin. Et on recommence, maintenant c'est intense. Tu dois te reposer pour quelques instants. T'es pas enfant, mais t'es dans une boîte de nuit. Bouge, car nous on danse la mapuka tous les nuits. Bouge, tous les nuits, baby, tous les nuits. Donne-moi la chaleur de ton corps sexy. Oui, retourne-toi sur moi, je suis fou de ça. Pourquoi t'ajoutes pas des pas autour de moi, c'est ça. Pas d'importance, t'es noir ou métisse. Pas d'importance, t'es grande ou petite. De Accra à Abidjan, je veux pas d'histoire. Quand je demande aux Ivoiriens, je demande. 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 Aux Ivoiriens.
Okay, so that was Mapuka with Reggie Rockstone, Lord Lust, and the fantastic Mensa. One of the things I really like about Mapuka was like the French rap. French rap is so nice, mm-hmm. And we hear very little of it. So I hope you enjoyed that. So we are back again with my guest, Joe Wacko.
Hi, what's up?
Hey. Mm. Tell me, what were you like as a child? What did you want to do?
I think as a child, what did I want to do? There was a moment I really wanted to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened to that. But then growing up, I just found myself to be a storyteller. Like I would write, like I remember in GSS, if they asked us to write an essay, that's like my favorite time. So I would write a lot. And then I think I wanted to be a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, I wanted to be
for
theater. So like it's still one of the things I'm pursuing, and I'm actively.
What's the state of theater?
Well, I think that's why I was like, you know what, theater. Like I felt like theater felt like a dream, or it felt like something that was like farther away, and there was no theater industry in Ghana. I've seen like productions from almost all the acting or active like theater practitioners in this country, and I've seen what they can do, and they are doing like a lot with like close to nothing, and which I feel like
mm-hmm.
it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
People are really breaking their back and still being able to revive, and these are like all young people. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll get back to theater, but I could still tell stories, and I realized that I'd go into film. So for me, I'd always known what I wanted to do. I'd known I'd wanted to be a storyteller. But the only thing that keeps changing is the medium. The medium keeps changing and shifting. But for the last three, four years...
Film is like the ultimate art form.
I think so.
Because it encompasses everything.
It's so collaborative. Yes. It's like the most collaborative art form
exactly,
that I know.
Exactly. And it needs all the other art forms
to be able to...
So, okay, so you're a screenwriter, filmmaker. You started off... apparently as a journalist.
Ah, yeah, I did.
So why did you become a journalist, and how does it impact your work as a screenwriter, and what was the catalyst?
I think
moving from one genre to another.
I think I realized that the stories, it got to a time that it was just reactionary. People just want to react to a story for like a cool 2 days, as long as it's hot, and then they move on to something else. So it just felt like, as a journalist, you need to be writing new stories every day. And then what is the whole point? Does it end after writing the story? Do you really have to follow up to see like if something is being done about these stories?
Again, and so remember, as I told you, anybody can set up a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need anything.
You don't need anything.
It's not something where you need to bring a speciality.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think of, like, I subscribe to the Guardian newspaper from the UK. You can get one particular story where you hear stories of where journalists spend 5 or 6 years, like the Pandora Papers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All that came out because some people diligently,
they were like, we want to do this.
It's important. And they took years to get to the bottom of this. But we seem to have, it's like a throwaway culture of, okay, this is hot today, 24 hours, it means absolutely nothing.
It means absolutely nothing.
And so then we move on, and then the newspaper is used to wrap up roasted plantain.
Yeah, so I just realized there was no space for me there. Like, in at least when I was actively like working as a journalist, I was like, there's no space for me here. So I just happened to find myself in spaces where I still write for some publications.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I'm going to write for a publication, most of the time my friends made me realize that they realize whatever story I write for a publication or whatever story I'm working on are stories that I really, really wish I could make movie, like I could turn into a movie. And they figure that out. And if you realize, like, there was this that I wrote about, like, the 20 years later after the Accra Sports Stadium disaster for Vice. And for me, it was something I wish I could have written as a movie, but then I couldn't. And then what is happening in Ghana about the queer community and all that is happening, it's something that I wish to see on screen, but as of now I can't like put that on screen. So you get me? So like those are, and I write stories that I wish about the dreadlock guy whose education has to be debated back and forth. I felt like,
and then funny enough, the head of the school who was so adamant that he shouldn't come there has somebody else's hair attached to her own head. And you wonder, you know, you're there, you can buy a weave, you've paid for it with your money. But I think when you are covering your own hair with somebody else's and you have an issue with somebody keeping their own natural hair, that for me, that dynamic in the conversation for me, I thought was just really surreal.
And it makes sense, very
Ghanaian.
And I'll be surprised to know when they were in court, lawyers had that on their hair as well, like,
yes,
during the court proceedings. Can we move on?
I suppose for the legal fraternity, you know, that wig means something.
I mean, it does mean something. Whatever it means, it's been years. Whatever it means, it's been years.
It's got to go.
It's everything. So it's sad. So these are stories that I just find myself writing, and I find myself like, because years to come, you tell a child that, you know, this happened, and they wouldn't believe. And I'll be happy to be able to pull up these stories just to show them that,
yeah
these
evidence.
Are the things that were happening. People's like education, like a 13-year-old boy had the whole country debating about hair and black hair culture in a black land.
In a black land.
Can you imagine? So these are the things that are happening.
Well, again, you see, I was whinging about TV and what we have on our TV and all of that. If you have, for me, my big thing is young girls. If you have young girls watching movies where attractiveness is associated with long Indian hair or long Latino hair or long Asian hair, how do you expect them to think about themselves when those are the standards of beauty they're being bombarded with?
And
then they look at Ghanaian presenters and they're also going exactly that same way. Where does anybody take pride in their own natural hair?
I mean, I think there's
Except for niche groups, you know.
It's sad. I mean, for the young girls coming up too, because the thing about beauty standard for women is it is being influenced by time, and it changes within like every 3 years, every 2 years. There was a moment that it was just like small boobs, tiny waist, fat ass was a moment, fat boobs, like women's beauty standard keeps changing all the time. So
well,
for
that's
these
because
young girls,
that's because for a long time women have been objectified.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, a lot of us have also bought into the into that industry. And yeah, what can we do?
I mean, it will get better. I like to say it will get better, but then I just like to say that just to move on, or mm-hmm. just to move the conversation on, because sometimes I don't really think it will.
Mm-hmm. What is the state of filmmaking in Ghana, and what have you seen in the industry? If there's anything you've seen in the industry that's made you feel that this is a game changer, this could be a game changer.
I feel I see more young people like being like collaborating, mm-hmm. and in as much as they might not reach out to you, whenever the project comes out, you could see this is the effort of a lot of young people, and I see young people going out of their way to make things happen. In as much as there isn't like a defined industry, there isn't an industry or anything of that sort, and I see a lot of younger people trying to tell stories that they really want to tell, than stories that people go like, this is what the industry really wants to see. How do you know this is what the industry wants to see when you haven't given the audience something else? So I see young people telling bold stories. I see more young people pushing boundaries. I see more young people just staying true to themselves and like being able to tell the story that they think they really need to tell. But then also, I just think one thing that really make the industry better is if the older people are able to like support these young people as well, because it's not a competition, honestly. Like in a few years, other people are going to rise. Like, it's an industry, and for every generation, right, there are people who are going to rise from every generation, and they need to work with the people that they came to meet. Like, not necessarily working with them, but we need to acknowledge and create space. People need to create space for people.
You mentioned the black tax.
Yes.
Exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
Where people, for instance, like you see some of our older singers, mm-hmm. who like were a big deal.
They were a big deal.
And yet the only time they seem to collaborate with younger people is when they're looking for relevance.
Because they think they've been forgotten. Yes.
But yes. You're the ones who should be.
Yes.
Pulling,
we should be able to build that, because in 20 years, in 20 years, in 30 years, in 10 years, I don't want to just be like a screenwriter. I want to be able to own a writer's room where I have like 20 young writers, 10 young writers, where it's
even
like
a place where you can churn out
writers
so that they can expand.
So you are building something for the point that like, if you are not there, or it shouldn't just be because you figured everything out yourself, coming up in the industry, the people coming next, that it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, for everywhere that there had been an industry, there had been like a conscious effort for people trying to raise other people, I should be able to see. I think I'll be so happy if I see a project that is I want more of co-writing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to watch a movie and see it written by three like fantastic writers.
That would be a really rich, it's like an enriching process.
I want to see a movie directed by two amazing directors who are not.
Well, the Coen brothers always direct.
I'm talking home. Like, I'm talking home.
But I even think that they don't actually direct. There's always one produces and one directs.
Exactly. There's always, I want more collaboration. That's the one thing that I would...
I mean, I think that's really, really important. I think the other thing is financing. And so a lot of times people end up doing things quickly as opposed to taking the time because of financing.
I think one major problem for financing is because we do not have records. We do not keep like records for I cannot pick a film, for example, this film X,
and
go like, oh, so for production, film X used this amount of money in the cinema, it made this from distribution.
Really, they don't keep that kind of information?
it should be made known. I feel like it should be a part of the industry news. Like, we should know how much this film was made for. Oh, we should,
the Nigerians do it,
and they brag about it, and they brag different, and it's so beautiful to watch it. And that's the way investors really want to come into the industry. Oh my God, I can really make this. Like, yeah, once there are records that are kept, I should be able to know how much the Ghana movie industry is making in a year. It shouldn't be one person's research process. It should be something that is there for an industry.
I think also the other thing is we're also funny about money.
Exactly. Like, the whole idea of money conversation isn't even had.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really have money conversation.
Yeah.
And even shows in our workplaces. You could be working for a place as long as you want and you don't know how much your co-worker earns. Like, the money conversation is quite sacred when it comes to our culture. And I feel it.
Yeah.
The more we have money conversation, for the movie industry, we need to have money conversations.
Because it also comes to a cult. Okay, so when I first moved to Ghana, I moved into an apartment block. And I remember whenever I traveled, first thing I do is I go and tell all my neighbors, I'm traveling, so this is my cousin, she's going to be staying here. So if you see this lady coming, it's okay, she's supposed to be here. But I noticed that when they traveled, they would never say anything to anybody. You know is that somebody's vanished.
Yeah.
And then you see them 2 weeks later, and you go, oh, Jale, I haven't seen Rana. And, oh, I traveled. Didn't I tell you? You know damn well you didn't tell me. And then it was talking to a friend who said to me, oh,
we are very, very...
It's a superstition that, you know, you don't tell
people when you are traveling.
Or things that you're doing. So there's also, I don't know if because of the superstition that somebody can, I don't know, put the evil eye on you or do something to stop your progress. So then there's, I think that also plugs into the secrecy around stuff.
I just think, like, naturally,
but
we are quite secretive around stuff unless stuff that do not concern us, for that we'll be bickering about. Unless we are, we are very secretive about, like, the most important things that we actually need not be secretive about. I should be able to know how much my movie, you should be able to know how much my movie is going to make from the box office. You should be able to know how much I put in production.
Do we even know what this? Because I know, like, for instance, with movies from other places, you know, okay, they have their production budget, but they even have like a marketing budget, which is nearly
as much as the production budget.
And then you know that, and this main actor is getting 10%
of this,
net or of whatever, this. Whatever. I don't know. What needs to be put in place for that to be, you know, for us to be able, for instance, for me to be able to go to a place, an office, and get information about the movies that were produced in Ghana, you know, where do you get that? Where do you access those kinds of information?
There isn't a space to access those kind of informations, but then you should be able to. I think it's if it's not invasive, if people are not going to find that quite invasive, you should be able to question your filmmaker friends. I should be able to call my friend and ask him, bro, oh, okay, that your film, it was dope. Okay, so how much? And then I don't expect them to lie to me.
Because,
like,
I need
to know.
Me with my series, I tell anybody who asks me how much I've invested. I invested that, and I haven't made it any of it back. But, you know, I can tell you how much I spent.
Yeah, so just so if I know how much Alba spent for her series and how much Alba made for her series, it's going to, like, make me take steps back. It's like, okay, what did she do wrong? What did she do right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's like, for my project, I'm also going to, like, avoid the mistakes, or maybe it's going to work differently around that. And then after that, I could give that information out. So we are building an industry just so we do not repeat, like, each other's mistakes.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that's not a thing that is happening.
Same mistakes as well.
Yeah, so we do not have that sort of conversation, and yeah, there isn't, like...
Do you think we understand the significance or the power of the audiovisual world?
Do I think we understand the significance of the power of the audiovisual
world?
The
significance and the power.
I like to think we understand. That is why we use it in the way we use it. Okay. Let's take. We understand the power of it. We understand the significance of it. Okay. We understand, but then again, everything comes to cultural. Let's pick a story like the dreadlock guy, for example. Mm-hmm. They know very well that Ghanaians, we are part of people, or we are like the rules are rules. Most Ghanaians are good, like rules are rules. Cut your hair, rules are rules. But they know the power. Like they know that through that audiovisual.
We are the most indisciplined bunch on the planet.
So exactly what I'm saying. Like they know that these people, right, are gonna come and tell you rules are rules, especially when it comes to things like this. And then even our secondary school system, right, is built on. I'm just trying to find the right word. Like I'm super careful when I'm trying to.
What, like colonialist principles?
There is that which is like is super built on like colonialist principles as well. But then it's built on a space where people are so attached to the high schools they attended to the point that they can't really see beyond the school's culture. It's like I'm a part of this school. Like for them, belonging to the school is bigger than. The school can't be wrong.
I think also, and then also religion plays it because
very big.
Because for instance, you could be a nurse. Okay, so I had to go to hospital for something, doing the card, and one of the questions they asked me was, "What religion are you?" And I said, "How does it impact the treatment?" And this nurse was furious with me, and she gave me a whole rant. And this was like when I first arrived, and gave me this whole rant about, you know, you have to be a Christian, blah, 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 blah. And she went off and she left me standing there. And then somebody else came, and I said, "Listen, I don't understand how any of this has to do with her role as a medical practitioner." And you know, the doctor apologized, and he did the thing. But I think we also allow. We've allowed our religion to infringe too much in everything.
In everything. We've allowed our religion
to
infringe.
And so it makes medical professionals not actually do their job because they're coming at it from, well, my religious principles say A, but your medical principles say B, you know.
Yeah, because most people, if you're still on that same issue, well, most people's arguments were, so if your son goes to school and your son starts smoking weed,
How has the dreadlocks got to do with weed? Mm. When I had dreadlocks, I had the same issue. That, oh, I'm a weed smoker. But the thing is this. If you as a parent have instilled the right values, because people always talk about home training. If your kid has good home training, some Rastafarian in his class is not going to take him off his path. And it's not that Rastafarian's fault. There's a choice that each person makes.
Moving off from the Rastafarian's guys to the anti-LGBT bill, it is the same conversation that we are having with religion.
Yes.
With religion and most people's argument is, okay, so what if a gay person comes to rape your child? Like, that's issue of rape and pedophilia. Like, do you really get it?
No.
That those are two things.
No, but statistics show that most people who are raping children are heterosexual men.
But they're not coming for that.
but this happens the world over. This conversation about male violence, mm-hmm. we don't have that. We don't have the conversation
about male violence. We pretend we care when it comes to.
We talk about, well, what did the woman do? Well, don't wear a miniskirt. It's always about restricting everybody else. Rather than talking with the real issue.
Why do you think it's so?
Well, because men are running most things. And I also think that, you know, for instance, when you have cases where domestic violence, I mean, you hear so many cases of the hostility that women face when they want to take something like that to court or when they go to the police station.
And it's usually one of those things they want to talk about it in those small beatings.
One that I heard of, which happened to somebody I know, was, you women, you won't shut up when you are being told to shut up, blah, 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 blah. And look at you now. You know.
Wow.
And so...
And he's being serious. Look at you now. He is really being serious.
It's like, why are you here wasting my time? You went and got this onto yourself.
If you had kept quiet.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of things that we don't address. And I don't know what's going to. I mean, have they passed that law now?
I do not. So I was getting my hair done. I was getting my hair done, and I was in this barber shop, and it was on TV. So everyone, you know how barber shops feels like a therapy space for men.
Yes.
And there were like a lot of men in the barbering shop, and then there was this one woman over there. So they just asked everyone what everyone thinks, and it got to my turn. They asked me what I think. I played deaf. And then the barber tapped me. I was like, "Oh, Rusty, will they talk to you? What do they think?" And I was like, I don't need to think about what to, like, I don't need to have a say. Like, it's, and I was like, they are not asking for it to be legalized. No one is asking for marriage rights for the LGBTQ community. No one is asking. They are just telling you they just want to live in peace. And they're like, "Oh, but they are living in peace already." I'm like, this is dishonest. And one guy says, "Oh, okay, you are saying this, you allow them to leave. If right now I say I want to sleep with you, would you agree?" And I ask him, "Do you want to sleep with me?"
Uh-huh. And he said?
And he said no. And I'm like, that is it.
So why are you?
So why?
But it's quite interesting that they seem to think that, for instance, a woman, 10 different men can ask you out, and there might only just be one that you're interested in dating. They don't seem to think that that also happens with...
I think the idea of consent is foreign to most of these people, so they just don't understand how consent to be in that space.
But even the thing of where they think that by virtue of you being a gay man,
you want every man,
you find every man attractive and you want to have sex with every man. That's the mentality.
It doesn't make sense. Because you, like, because as a straight man, you don't find every woman
attractive. Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, let's leave these people behind.
literally.
Yeah. I watch a lot of films and I wonder whether there was a screenplay involved.
Mm-hmm.
Why are screenplays important for a movie? You know, and the importance of Africans telling the African story from the African perspective in a way that is uplifting, mm-hmm. as opposed to the juju man with the wide circle around his eye sitting mm-hmm. in some corner doing.
I just feel like when we talk about our culture, it has, I mean, even now, if you go back, we have reasons for doing things, right? And you could have a story. Everyone has a story, but not everyone can really put that down in a screenplay. We could have you waking up in the morning every day, but like, it will only take a very good screenplay for us to see you waking up very exciting. What makes you wake up? Why do you even wake up? If you wake up, what's the first thing you do? How important is the first thing you touch when you wake up to your life? So like, screenplay is when
you're
able... What's
the first thing that you do when you wake up?
The first thing I do when I wake up, not today. Basically, I'm like, do I want to do this again today? Really? It's like, I was in a space where, especially after COVID and during the lockdown, it was, I don't know, I felt like there was something in the air.
I loved it.
You loved it?
I was locked in my house.
I lost track of time. I don't know if you did. Like, you didn't during the lockdown.
I just watched loads.
I had lost track of time. So, like, it could be like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and mm-hmm. I'm super active.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm super active, like, and around 1 p.m., I'll be sleeping. Because, like, that's like a night time. Like, things have shifted around. Yeah. So, and even on the internet didn't even help, because you go on Twitter or you go on Instagram, like, 2 a.m., people are having an argument. Like, it's lively, because there's no job. Everyone is working from home.
Yeah.
But then I think, back to your question, the first thing I do when I wake up, first thing I touch is probably my phone. Yeah, I think so. I think the first thing
you
I do when I wake up, I stay
missed.
In bed. I think I just like to stay in bed for a minute or two, just be there,
mm-hmm.
pick my phone, see if I have to check my reminders and see what I'm doing for the day, and then zoom off. So first thing I usually do is just touching my phone, because like, it has everything I need on.
Okay.
What about you?
I meditate.
Oh, you meditate. You ask me first thing I touch. Not first.
First thing you do.
Oh, I do. I mean, yeah, I pray. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so screenplays, the importance of screenplays.
I feel like screenplays are able to, like, they help you to progress the story. They help you to plot out the story, to develop it. And then screenplays are the only way where we are able to get to know, like, a series of events that really define the character, or a series of events that really leads us to the very story you are trying to tell. So screenplays are very, very important. And I feel like we as Africans, we have our perspective, we have our ways of seeing things. Whether you like it or not, we are exaggerative beings. And like, we at Africa, like, the drama, it's drama. Like, we are very, very dramatic people. So whenever you are writing a screenplay, we should be able to have that element of us in it, and not, but
people, it shouldn't be 100%.
Exactly what, like, I was getting to that. But there've been moments where I've been upset and I don't want to, like, it's just silence.
Silence, yeah.
And you just, like...
And the thing is, we do that. For instance, you go to a funeral. Mm-hmm. You have the people who wail and roll around, and you have that person who can't say a word. Who's just, you know, and all of that is ours. It's, you know, it's a range of human emotions.
Yeah, and I also feel like with the screenplays, and I see people, I talk to other young film, like, screenwriters, and then it's like, we know it has to be a body, like an intro, body, conclusion, like breaking it down, but then not in, like, in no particular order. So I'm just fine.
Well,
like,
films can be non-linear, and they've been like that for
a
long time.
You just need
to do it in a way that your audience can
really understand and time jump with you. Yeah, so I feel like screenplays are super, super important. Like, they're as much as...
It's like your blueprint.
It's the blueprint for everything.
Okay, so tell me about... talk about screenplay writing. How do you find the work, and then what is your process? What's the process of writing? How is the idea generated? For instance, somebody comes to you and says, I want you to write this script for me. This is my idea. How does that generate? Then what drives the narrative? And yeah, so what is your process from beginning to end?
It depends on the process. It depends when it's my own project that I'm writing. For that, I find the inspiration from things around me. Like, I find the inspiration from... And I do realize that there are times that I start writing a short story, which isn't... I have no idea. It doesn't really necessarily have to be a screenplay or a film. I start writing a short story, and then I leave it there. 2 years later, I start writing the story, and I realize... this could be the end to this. If you bring this to this side, it's really going to work. So usually my ideas come from, like, old projects that I have already, and then my idea come from my experience with people, like my experience with you right now. If I go back, I'll just think through, like, what was the highlight of the day, what was my highlight of the day, what story do I need to tell. So for me, every time I'm looking for ideas, I find inspiration, like, in the morning when I woke up and I hear, like, the Muslim man calling for prayer. That's, like, inspiration for me. When I see the people jogging around in the morning, it's inspiration for me. People try to catch a ride to work, people trotter me around in the office with my friends. So, like, the inspirations are all around me, unless I decide. So the process,
you've gotten an idea, you've been inspired by a lot of things, and now
I decide to write a story. What is next?
You decide to write the story. What is your process? And for me, I'm interested in, what is the best time of writing for you? Are you the type of person who would plot out the story and know where you're going before you start, or do you start the writing journey and see where it takes you? That kind of process.
I start writing and see where it takes me. But then what also helps is that before I even go to start writing, I take some time for myself to know who my characters are. I like to know my characters so well.
How do you do that?
I like to write characterization.
So you do, like, a treatment.
I do, like, a character bible for, like, each character. I go, like, okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to write, like, a day in the character's life. There are moments where I like to write a day in the character's life. So if this character wakes up, what does he do? Who are the people in the character's life? Where is this character coming from? Where is this character going? So it helps me build his or her relationship, character A's relationship with character B. And then, so once I know all these characters, I go out a lot, I talk to people, and this is before I even start my treatment. I talk to people a lot, whether you know someone like this in your life, you know someone like that in your life. And I realize that I find myself writing a lot of stories where my characters do not have like a day job. There's this character that I have whose job is he makes dog foods and then he plays in a club at night. That's not a conventional job for a Ghanaian film. A Ghanaian film, your character is a lawyer, is a doctor, is an engineer. But then we have these diverse characters.
That's the old school story.
That is it. But then, so for me, it's like I meet people who are like, oh, you do this for a living? That's going to be the job I'm going to give to my character. I meet someone and like they do this for a living. I'm like, it's interesting. What if my character is this man who drives a baller car and just goes to pick baller every morning? What is the rest of the day like for this character? How does his wife see him as a man who carries waste?
Or is he like a sailor and as he's driving around has a girl in each area that he passes
through? So how did he even end up driving this? Okay, could it be possible that he was a driver for maybe this agency, the agency collapsed and he's been looking for driving job? So like, how did he end up here? So I like to be able to plot out the characters, talk to a few more people, then I go for treatment.
And so if you were writing something about the baller car guy, you would talk to baller car workers.
I would stand in front of my house and wait for them to come. When they're coming to pick the baller, I talk to them. I'm going to build a relationship with them. I'm going to text them. I'm going to call them. So whenever there was a time that I was talking to about 3 or 4 doctors at the same time, because for me, I just wanted to compare their experiences. I was talking to a Muslim doctor, I was talking to a Christian doctor, I was talking to a doctor who doesn't believe in God, like a doctor who's just winging it and everything. So for that, it gives me like a depth of knowledge of like stripping my characters of. There are things that I don't give my characters. There are times that when I'm writing, I don't decide whether my character is a Christian or Muslim, because I like to believe that in as much as some of our decisions are influenced by our religion, there are a lot of our decisions are influenced by the fact that we are humans.
Yes.
So I just like my characters to be humans first, and then I go like, okay, do I assign them religion? Do I assign them a class? Do I assign them sexuality? Do I assign them power? So like all these things come along like as the story develops and goes.
And how do you because obviously there's a structure. You can play around within the structures, but obviously there needs to be some. I find it interesting that you just start writing without a loose idea of at least certain climatic points.
I actually do.
Okay.
So let's go back. I often know how my story will end, or I don't know how it will end, but then I often know a climatic point.
Yes.
So now there are times that I write to meet that point.
Yes.
And then continue from
okay.
there. Because, and then there are times that I just know how the story will end.
Yeah.
But then how did they get there?
Yes.
So I just start looking for how they got there. There are instances where it's just a sentence someone had said, and I'm like, so I'm currently working on a story, like my next feature film, right? It's a story I found on Instagram.
In fact, okay, that's interesting.
It's a story I found on Instagram.
But do you also look for stories like in newspapers and magazines and online and stuff like that?
Okay, so it depends on the kind of story I'm writing. So for the one we're talking about, the Independence Day audio drama,
yes.
For something like that, during the writing process, I had to look for a lot of newspapers, a lot of articles that were set in from 1956 to 1957.
Where like did you reading, find those newspapers?
There are some at the Baum Library, and I have friends and family who have some of these newspapers. And then, interestingly, the British have a lot of those things than we actually do. They have documents.
They have everything.
Yeah, you go online and you realize that most of these things that you see, you're either finding them from like an European like publication.
That's because they also own all the rights
to
all
the
Yeah,
they own the rights to these
everything.
Things. So for something like that, I like to read. And usually when I'm reading these stories, I'm not reading the headlines, or I'm not reading like the selling stories. I pick the newspaper. If I pick a 1957 newspaper, of course there might be something about Ghana's independence, but I'm just going in there to read about how the people were living
at that time.
So that my interest is in Nkrumah is coming to declare. My interest is this teacher here did this. 13 people have been found here. The story. So like, I'm looking for the social stories that were developing around these big headlines.
Yes.
So like, there are times that I just go back to newspapers and then I read what was happening during that time, and there are times that I read books as well, but then I just try not to project or not to make them seem like, oh, copy and paste, because from what I read from a newspaper is different from a dialogue, is different from how it will be presented in a dialogue. I just need to have a knowledge,
but
a certain,
what you just need is a framework, a certain
of how things worked around that time, what's happening, or the mindset of the people around that time. So there is that too. And it also depends on projects that I'm working on. There are certain projects that I wouldn't even have to even read any old thing.
Yeah.
Like, it just comes to you, because, and there are some projects that you always have to go back to it.
And so what about, these are your own projects, what about a project that somebody brings to you? Are you one of those people who has, because, like, for instance, I have a friend who, she has to write a certain amount of words every day. There are people who say, I have to write for, and obviously the issue of consistency is very important, because obviously you improve your craft, but how do you write?
For me, when it comes to writing, there's a project in which I don't know whether it's healthy or not, but I could pick a project and I know today if I wake up, I need to write like maybe 4 more scenes of this project. And I like, and then maybe a scene of this project. So I could be working on 2 things. Like that. I mean, in the morning, when I wake up in the morning, first things, like right after getting out of bed, I like to write before I come out of my room.
Okay.
When I wake up in the morning, I flip my laptop, sometimes on my bed behind my desk. I write before I step out into the hall.
Okay.
Like, I just be there for like the first hour or the first 2 hours. It's just me trying to write. And then I just go in, because there are times when I'm going to sleep, I know if I wake up, I'm working on the story. So throughout my sleep, I'm thinking of where I ended
Your
off. I'm thinking of subconsciously. So when I wake up, I just write. And then in the nights before I sleep, like in the nights, I wake up like in the nights before I sleep, like the last 2 hours as well, I just try to like move on with the stories that I'm writing. So for me, it's been a habit. Because the whole point is that there will be multiple projects. I don't have the luxury of like being hired by a studio, where you just have to be able to write. I have in between writing my scripts in the morning and the evening, there's my day job in the middle,
which is
I work at Muse Africa, where I work as like head of production for every content that really goes out. So that is like a lot of work as well. So I make time for that. That's like what gets, that's my day job. And that's what feeds me. And I'm a podcaster as well. I create podcasts from the studio too. So there is that too happening. So between all, I need to find time to be able to follow my passion, which is the filmmaking. So I have those times.
So Lucky was a screenplay that you wrote. How long did it take you? Talk about that process. So somebody comes to you and says, did you write the screenplay yourself, and then a director looked at it and said, oh, I really love this, I'd like to shoot it? Or did somebody come to you and say, I have this idea about this, can you expand it and make it, create that world for me?
I think it all goes back to like social media again. And there was a time I used to post a lot of stories. So this guy had reached out to me via DM and says, his name is Kusi, and says, bro, we need to make a film. Like, yeah, you're a good writer, I see the stuff you write, what's up, let's make a movie. And around that time, I had like short films. I had had like, I think 2 or 3 short films that I had written and directed. And so that was something he had seen, and he thought, oh, this is a guy I could really work with. But then, before then, I've had more people come to my DM, say the same thing, we have projects, let's work. And I realized more people in Accra like the idea of working than when it's actually time to work. So I was like, I didn't pay any attention to him. I thought it was just one of those person comments. And this guy comes back again. He's like, have you thought of what I said? I'm like, yes, even though I hadn't. And I was like, yeah, I've been thinking, what's up? He's like, oh, okay, we'll meet in town. So I went for a party and I met a guy at a party, and the guy was like, oh, your name came up at this guy, he mentioned you, and there's this girl who, Buki was my friend, she invited me to this party, so she introduced me to the director. And mind you, at this time the script hadn't been written, there was no script, there was no, but I had already met the director, I had already met some of the cast already. So it was a very communal thing. I had already met some of the cast. So I was in my office one time, and one guy comes to me and is like, yeah, I made time for them to come through and tell me what the story is. So you know, one of those things that they came to me with a story, okay, this is what happened, but like, it was an idea than a story. it was an idea than a story. So I was like, okay, there's something I can work with. So I asked them to give me a month.
Okay.
And within the month, like, I was just plotting it out. I think the first thing about Lucky I wrote was the ending.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the last scene
Sometimes it comes quicker.
Yes, yeah, so I wrote the first scene. I wrote the last scene first. The last scene, after writing the last scene, and I was so interested when it came to characterization. For the mother's job, I was like, okay, so I don't see these women in movies. I want to see a mother who owns a shop in Makola. So it's like, these are women, if I talk of representation, the Makola women. And also around that time, I was reading a lot on the Ghana's independence, and I knew the Makola women were so strong, behind
Nkrumah,
people who were. So it's like, you know what, for this lead character, I'm going to back to what actually defined this country. These Makola women, they are the strongest women, or like economically, these women had all the money.
But apart from also having the money, because there's Rebecca Aite, all of those ladies. Apart from that, they organized the market women, and they also carried the news across the country when they went to the markets.
They've been talking about themselves, so like they were sort of. So I wrote the first draft. Mm-hmm. I think in about a month, I wrote the first draft. I sent it to them. They're like, ooh, that was good. They liked it. But then I didn't like it. I didn't like it because...
But it was a first draft.
It was a first draft, and I didn't like it because I had told them, give me a month. So I was writing to meet the month. Whether it was good or not, I know I was writing. But then again, I was still young in the industry. I think I wrote Lucky at 23. I was so young, and it felt like I had told them they'll receive it in a month. Whatever it is I needed to write. But looking back now, I wouldn't feel the same way, because I am more forgiving of myself when it comes to first drafts. I don't expect any. No. Like, my first draft is like...
Yeah.
But at that moment, I was like, ah. So I went back for a second draft, and then by the time I got to third draft, it was taking shape, it was taking form, and I was like, yes, this is the story I really wanted.
So how many drafts did it need?
I think we went in for like about 7 drafts for Lucky.
And then what was the time frame?
The time frame was like about 2 extra or 3 extra months, because around that same time they were having pre-production. So I think we started pre-production with the 4th draft or 3rd
uh-huh,
draft.
Uh-huh.
So as they are doing, because it had like all the most
By
of
then
the things.
You had it most,
yeah, yeah, it had most of the things that
like
we needed.
The fine-tuning,
yeah, so around
and
the 4th draft we had started pre-production, we had started location scouting, because the houses, we knew the houses already.
Mm-hmm.
And around all those same time, while we were having the audition, we were doing everything, I was still getting more drafts out, because
mm-hmm.
I know that by the time we have our final cast, they should be able to have the final script. So it was a process that really didn't end for me. For me, my work on Lucky ended when they had finished shooting.
Because
it was like, yeah.
Were you having to rewrite stuff?
I wasn't having to rewrite once we had started.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that there were some scenes that we couldn't shoot because of timing, because
mm-hmm.
of finances and everything. But
mm-hmm.
then those scenes, like, it broke my heart, but then we were still able
and
to tell the story.
It was very cine verite, so you couldn't just lock. And I think when you were talking about this whole thing of you didn't see women, and they were either the lawyer or something corporate.
Yeah.
I think that's also a production thing in the sense that
it's easier
to control. If you rent a house,
it's easier to... You can't control Makola.
You can't control Makola. We were chased out of there. I went to mm-hmm. shoot a commercial there. We had to run for our lives. So
I get that too. So I was writing Lucky for me was an eye opener. It was an eye opener for me, and it did what it had to do for my career. Like
mm-hmm.
it took me to like the next level, and it's something like I'm super proud of, and I always privileged to have had like a right first feature.
And also to be involved along
the
way, because usually screenwriter, you finish
it's
and
difficult.
It's end
it's,
of your story.
Yeah,
and
because
you move
it's
on.
Yeah, it's so difficult for people to get a break. But then for me, all the times that I have really had to work on any project, I hadn't gone knocking. It had just
they've always
been,
come to you.
Just
yeah, that's
into
because
me,
you've been putting your calling card out there. Okay, let's go for a musical break. You bought a Papa Janssen and a Paulina Udro song.
Oh, yes.
Why did you choose this one?
Tnamencheng.
Why?
But then I also Tnamencheng because, still, let's talk about film, right?
when I watch Ghanaian films and I see, I want to be able to watch a movie where it starts from where a 50-something-year-old man and a 40-something-year-old woman are starting a relationship. I want to see what love means to them. I want to see their rituals. I want to see how they talk. I want to see.
Have you ever seen Queen Sugar?
I love Queen Sugar.
Okay. Aunt Vi and Hollywood are like relationship goals.
And these are old people. Yes. These are like old people.
And Aunt Vi is older than Hollywood.
Exactly. You know? It's like it's a man who is like they are both not in their prime. Like they are old. They've lived. But then at this moment, these older people have come together. It's like
they're in their prime because like the way they live.
You get, and I think it's because of the influence around them. There's like the.
But Aunt Vi was a no nonsense person from the beginning, from season one.
She's been a no nonsense person.
Yeah.
So I think I chose that because whenever I hear Tina Menchen, right, I imagine a 40-year-old woman and maybe a 50-year-old man who had met at an outdoor-y or who had met at an event they got invited to and they want to kick spark off. So maybe a widower and a divorcee.
Okay.
So I just want to, they've been in love before, they have loved before, but then they want to give love a chance
again.
So like that's what the song reminds me of. And it's a movie I really want to make one time. I want to make a movie where we just go in from adult 50, 40, starting love, meeting again. Because I want to see what it feels like for them.
I think also by that time, you know, you don't need to prove anything to anybody.
Yeah, but so let's take a dive into their relationship. Because
yeah.
Like there's a man who knows... If you say this, you are lying. Like, cause I have lived. I've had three wives. I've been divorced three times.
And I found somebody who wants me.
So it's like, let's see. So that's why I love the song. I'm a sucker for romance.
Okay, let's listen to that, and then we're gonna come back and wind ourselves down.
Come on, you're not ready. What's on your mind? do ashemi ma
me se me riazin ile mawo
unwe ni je ashemi ma baby
Demin si don't you break my heart
I have never dated.
Okay. Why not?
I don't know. I don't know.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
AB, shall we arrange somebody?
Yeah, shall you arrange somebody?
No. I think you're a very strong guy.
Why? Why do you say that?
Because we live in a society where, you know, you, guys will see you wearing nail varnish and you haven't dated.
Ah.
They will start you.
No, but then I feel like it's a whole lot of responsibilities, and I feel if I'm really gonna date, there's a whole level of emotional maturity and emotional responsibility which I should be in a space where I'm ready for that.
Please say it louder, because there are men who are age 60 who still haven't learned this lesson. Oh no, I think it's important. I think it's important that people know exactly
what they want.
What they want, as opposed to everybody's doing it, so I have to do it. But I'm sure you have a lot of ladies who are interested in you.
Ladies and guys.
I do.
I mean, I have a lot of people interested in me.
Yeah.
I'm quite a good looking boy. I'm a catch.
check you out. Okay. Yes. Of the scripts that you've written, or the films that you've made, short film, feature, whatever, which has been your favorite and which has been the most challenging?
Boys Know the Cry had been my favorite as a short film, and Boys Know the Cry was my favorite because it was my friend's final year project at a film school in London, and it won like best production, and it was a story I wrote for him, and it's about mental health. It follows the young man in a hyper-religious home who was having to battle mental health. And then I realized it was a moment where mental health wasn't spoken about. When people were going to talk about mental health, it was usually women were allowed to be open about their emotions. Men were supposed to like bottle it up and man up and just face it. And if you are not lucky and you happen to be from a hyper-religious home, like my character, you are going to be taken to church and they are going to pray for you, because for them,
they do not understand it, and beat demons out of you. And one thing I was able to do there with Boys Need to Cry was how we were able to have time to explore the relationship sons have with their mothers, which is something like I do not really get to see a lot of that. Like, it was really explored well, where a woman, we had a lot of emails.
Genuine relationship. Not the usual mother coming to interfere.
It's genuine. It was a point of his weakness where he felt like, I need to open up to my mother. And when you're like, yeah, he needed to open up to my mother. I said, yeah. And then when he opened up to his father, the response was different. Like, his father was always putting him down. Like, if you have someone always putting you down, you can't like rise up. And then for the mother was always like uplifting him, so he couldn't really feel down around his mother. So I just felt like we had a lot of emails, we had a lot of DMs, we had a lot of like publications calling to talk to us about the project, because it was a new dawn for people to address mental health issues. And it was even pronounced in the other form of content or the other art forms that really came out of Ghana that year, especially when people were going into lockdown and we didn't know how we're going to come out of the lockdown. So it was a project that I have been super proud of, and it's my favorite project beyond like what it really means. But then the reception, the people, just last week I had this girl from Kenya or Gambia, I do not remember exactly, and I really apologize for that. I had her reach out to me. She was in film school. She interviewed me about the project, and it was a final project, and she felt like she showed the entire film to people in her department, and they watched it. So she called, and she felt as part of a project, she would like to interview the writer of the show, and it's part of like a thesis. And I felt like those were the things that really were important to me. Like, I made a film at a point where I was going through it, and then I realized that more people needed to actually see this film for people to be even writing about it and calling me to talk about it. So I had to tell people that. There were times I tell people when they call me on their shows, I told them, I'm sorry, I'm not a mental health advocate. Like, I just happen.
You know what we actually need in this part of the world?
No.
We need Inyala Van Sant to come and fix our lives. She deals with generational trauma.
Yeah.
And so she comes into families, somebody writes to her and says this issue, and she comes into families and she tries to take everybody back to
where it might have started.
And so sometimes you have something, and grown adult women with children or sons with children, and Inyala is telling their mother, this person talking to you is a 5-year-old child. It's something that I think as black people we haven't addressed.
And from where I stand, I think like for black men as well, like especially black men, we should
There's
be able to.
There's a huge burden to be a man. Something yeah. that, you know, and it's also a definition of man that is not changing. Whereas women, once upon a time, you were just a homemaker, but then you're in the workforce, you're doing this. And so what constitutes being a woman is continually expanding. But with what being a man is, you are the head of the household, you are the one who's in charge, and you have to continually be strong. And beyond that, any man who wants to be beyond that, it then becomes something that's problematic. Together.
Ah, that's sweet.
Together. Okay, three final questions.
Okay, I hope they are nice.
What is the common misconception people have about screenwriting?
The common misconception that if you have a story, you can write a screenplay.
Thank you. Okay. I totally agree with you. People just think, oh, why are we paying you? Why do you need all this time to do this? Okay, so somebody's heard you and they want to get into filmmaking, screenwriting. What advice would you offer them?
Watch more films, read more book, have an open mind, have conversations with people, travel
a
lot.
Do you think they should go to film school?
If you get a chance to go to film school, you should. For me, I just believe in as much as it could come as a talent, it could learn on the force. But then once you are in a film school, the network you are building there also helps, because
yes.
you have other people in other departments who are going to reach out to you. So the networking help, the skills also help. Once like a polished talent is better than like raw talent, so you should go to film school if you can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't go to film school, watch a lot of videos,
movies.
A lot of master classes, a lot of videos, travel around, read books, write more. Like
mm-hmm.
you need to write more. You just don't need to wait to be commissioned before you write. If anyone should call me right now and they tell me they want a script, I will find one for them. Like, it's like you should be able to, because that's the only thing that really makes you a writer. You should be able to write.
So they
more.
Should at least be trying to write something.
Be trying
every
to write
day.
Every day. Every because there were times in my life where I wake up and I feel like I don't feel like writing. I'm waiting to be inspired, and it hits me. A banker doesn't go to work because they feel like banking. A doctor goes to work because it's a new day. So if I'm a writer, the whole point of, I understand people saying they want to be inspired, but if I'm not inspired to write this, I should still be able to write something,
which is something that I for many years I've been trying to do, and I don't, because I've gotten into a bad habit of, I have a project, I have to write something
deadline.
For somebody. It's when the
deadline
is there.
The deadline.
And I'm pushed in a corner and then I just produce.
The thing about that thing is, the thing about doing that is, it sometimes forces you to believe that you work well under pressure.
Yes.
No, you don't. Have you given yourself the chance to actually write and do?
Well, I was talking to a life coach about that, about being a procrastinator, and he said, no, there are four different types of people. There's the helper, the warrior, there's two others. And he said, you're a warrior, you're a fighter, you come into being when there's a battle. And so I was like, okay. He said, don't call yourself a procrastinator.
Well,
you disagree with that?
I do not disagree with that. Like, different things work for different people. But
yes.
then I just feel like, I hate to tell myself that you work well under pressure. No, I don't want pressure. I want to be able to plan my time so well. But I catch myself postponing. And then when the deadline is tomorrow, I mean, I'm putting my phone off, like, going all out.
Yeah.
But I don't need that pressure.
yeah.
And I sometimes see that I'm still able to deliver under the pressure. But
and
then, would it be
good?
It's so good. Adrenaline.
Yeah.
And, I'm like
and I also think, I mean, I always say to myself that when I'm doing what I think is procrastinating, it's all cooking.
I'm thinking, I'm cooking, I'm building. So yeah, there's that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have your social media handles.
Ah, okay. So my on Twitter is Jowackle,
uh-huh.
GH. Jowackle and GH. So like it's Jowackle GH. And
mm-hmm.
on Twitter is Jowackle. On Instagram is Jowackle, Jowackle. And on Facebook is Jowackle J Kusi. On
okay.
LinkedIn, Jowackle J Kusi. So yeah. And
okay.
Yeah. And I have a podcast. You guys should listen to my podcast.
What's your podcast?
It's called Check Your DM, and I talk to like African celebrities and about their life, their career, and then sex and sexuality in the digital age. So you have like your favorite artist coming there to talk about what is really happening in their DMs, because the show is called Check Your DM.
Mm-hmm.
So you could listen to it wherever you listen to your podcast.
The nonsense that some of us receive is not funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very
to
much
share
for having
world
me.
Of writing
I'm so excited.
Everything. I really hope that you and I get a chance to collaborate.
Listen, it's something that has happened, and I see the thing about collaboration is right. I just allow it to happen.
Okay.
Sometimes the project just drops and it's the right project. No matter what you do, it is this person you need to work on that
exactly.
project with.
Exactly. So let it.
When it drops, it's
let it come
don't shout.
In. Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for taking your time to join us. Thank you, Abraham, for holding everything down behind the scenes. And you, audience, thank you very much for tuning in. We are on Africa Radio. Africa Global Radio. We are on. You got to cut that out, okay? Thank you all for tuning in. We are on AfricaGlobalRadio.com. We are on Twitter at AF Global Radio and also on Facebook, Africa Global Radio. And of course, you can send us a WhatsApp on +233 207 064680. Arts Africa is brought to you by Africa Global Radio. My name is Alba K. Sumprim, and this has been Arts Africa on Africa Global Radio. We are signing out with... I was playing vintage Reggie Rockstone. We are signing out with his most recent hit, and it is called Move Faster, and it is hot off the press this month. So have a great weekend. Enjoy this track, and let's meet here again on Arts Africa next Saturday at 12 p.m. sharp. Thank you.
Faster.
Huh? Move faster.
No.
All right, then. GTP. Girl Too Pretty.
A classic, and at the same time, progressive.
My baby, you're my baby. You gotta move faster. Your body is amazing, but you gotta move faster. Hey, you're giving me anointing, so you gotta move faster. Hey, tonight gonna be amazing, so we gotta move faster.
All right.
You got me hooked up to your love, girl. I know they feel my face. I'm gonna get wanna be your lover, cause I did feel your steez. Oh, na 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 na, no the MC Hammer. The way you do the move, make I want to hammer. Sexy lover, you make I come faster. All over the world, the only one bada. My baby, you're my baby. You gotta move faster. Your body is amazing, but you gotta move faster. Hey. You're giving me anointing, so you gotta move faster. Hey. Tonight gonna be amazing, so we gotta move faster.
All right.
Your body like, she had a money style high black boots with a NYC written on your poopy la la. She the X, she's sexiness. Tell Reggie Rockstone where you getting all the stamina. She got me begging, please. Stay that visa, girl. Why don't you stay up and got me now? And I celebrate you and your sexy self. Booty and good health, you're doing for Africa. Got beautiful creation, body's amazing. Intelligent, black, strong, on the same page I'm on. Physical attraction. You remind me of a song you write, even when you're wrong. Looking good in space, suit, jeans, a thong. What you made or what you want, your smile is warm. Halle Berry got nothing on you, girl, you the storm. For you, Reggie Rockstone wrote this song.
Your my baby, you're my baby. You gotta move faster. Your body is amazing, but you gotta move faster. Hey, you're giving me anointing, so you gotta move faster. Hey, tonight gonna be amazing, so we gotta move faster.
All right.
What's your name?
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.